Well, on 22 May 88.
So that was the discovery, as far as I was concerned. I heard about it, must have heard about it, the very first moment it was announced, because Willie wrote to me and on the instant and told me that, right, that things had been found.
But now, as you begin to have 5, 10, 20 of these quasi-stellar objects, as they became called, what did you make of them in that first year?
I didn't make of them very much, and I think that it's at this point you have to give Martin Schmidt full credit that he drove through the investigation of those first objects out to large redshifts. I think it was, what it, 3C9, was it, something?
I think that's right, yes.
Yeah, that, with a big redshift.
Right.
He drove that smartly through with remarkable speed once, mm-hmm, the thing was there, so that by the time my attended a seminar that Schmidt gave in Caltech, maybe as you said, about the end of the next year, I was amazed at how they'd managed to get spectra and so on and, mm-hmm, follow it up. I think that in a way was Schmidt's following up of the discovery was, yeah, really more remarkable than the discovery itself.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, very good. It was quite clear. I had no thought at all at that time that the redshifts might not be cosmological. No thought at all. And, mm-hmm, to me, it was clear that they were. And it was also beginning to be clear that I realized this was a much more direct threat to the steady-state cosmology than I'd ever felt the counting of radio sources was. Because the redshifts were big, and so there was a means of testing. What my idea was, and I think of other people at the time, was that the redshifts were so big when I heard about two, that now it would be possible to carry out Alan Sandage's test, what we now call the Q0 test,
right,
that it would be, it would be very quick to settle the whole matter and see what the curvature factor was. And so I had a feeling that now the matter was going to be settled. So I think by the time there had been 20,
yeah,
I had this feeling that we're on the verge now of... And that probably the theory was going to be wrong. That was the way I felt about it in 64. I'd also...
Why did you feel the theory was going to be wrong?
Well, I had, together with a chap called Taylor in England, I'd recovered some of Gamow's early results on the helium production, the stuff that Bob,
yes,
Wagner, Willie Fowler and I generalized later. I'd done that in 64. I'd had a conversation that in retrospect was very unfortunate, that we didn't make one more move with Bob Dickey. We were both at a summer school at Verena up on Lake Como. Bob told me that they were preparing to do an experiment at Princeton, the experiment that,
right,
that Penzias and Bob Wilson, that we've just been talked about, actually did. He told me, I said, well, what sort of temperature are you expecting?
No, let me get this straight. Dickey told you that his own group was preparing to do an experiment.
Yeah, that's right.
Right,
that's
he didn't know about Penzias.
He didn't
Moses.
Know at all, no. So I said, what temperature? And he said about 10 degrees.
Right.
I said, well, that won't do, Bob. He said, why not? I said, because Andrew McKellar got the bands of CH and CN around 1940, and it's a excitation temperature of 3 degrees.
So you immediately pointed that out to him?
Yeah, I pointed this out to George Gamow, that his temperature was too high. And if we'd only said, well, it is 3 degrees, we'd,
yeah,
have had it.
Yeah.
He didn't have done his experiment. That is the worst mistake of my life, I tell you. Bob and I, between us, we had it then, because he was convinced it existed, and I knew the temperature.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and we didn't put it together. We could have written our letters in H.
But you had pointed this out to Gamma.
Yes.
At what time?
55.
Amazing. Now, something that has always puzzled me, I mean, I'd like to hear your opinion on it, and maybe you talk to some of the principals. is that in the late 40s, one of course had this, I always like to think of it sort of as an intimation. I mean, they never come out in any of the papers and say, here's a temperature we should look for, you know, or there's nothing like that. But it's in there. It's in there in the equations. No one acted on this. As microwave technology improved through the 50s and radio astronomy went to higher... Why was this?
Well, I think I didn't do anything because I was conscious of this feature of 3 degrees being the highest possibility. And that looked, I suppose, to the technology too difficult.
It would have been very difficult. Dickey was precisely the man to do it, even in the early 50s.
Yes. I think he said 10 degrees because he felt he could do 10 degrees. And so you never go around, as it were, sort of hammering into people's heads that when they're willing to do some work, that it might be useless, you know.
Yes, so yes. Right.
I think that has a certain part to play. Then, of course, the pendulum. I'd done the helium calculations. I firstly did them, and it was a question of checking all the details. And Taylor came in with me, and he had more time than I had, and he checked the details, and we published this in Nature. At that time, I hadn't realized that one of Gamow's students had pretty well got it right. Gamow's original publication, he'd done the beta theory wrong. That's why I did it, why I repeated it. I realized he hadn't done it right.
And who is that student?
Taylor.
No, who is that student of Gamow's?
It's Alpha Folin and Hermann, but I wasn't aware of that paper at that time. They did it the same way that we did it.
And so this was causing your confidence in steady state to shake a bit.
Then the microwaves were discovered. And just on that discovery, before I actually saw the technical report, I was asked to give the public lecture at the British Association. And it was given in the Senate House in Cambridge. And it was afterwards printed in Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And what I said was that there'd been a whole set of converging lines of evidence against the theory, and that it will be settled very shortly because the redshifts of the quasars were so large that we would see on the Hubble diagram very clearly what the truth was. And that is printed in Nature.
Right, so, but were you considering the microwave background as a setback at that stage?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
But certainly. So I was hovering then on the position that Dennis Sharma, Dennis got out very fast, as he said, he recanted. I was on the point of it in that lecture and would have done so if when the quasars were the number that were detected, and they were detected very quickly at that stage, so that within a year it was adequate to take a look at it.
Right.
But by the end of the year we had about 50, and by the end of 66, something like that. Burbage and I put them on a redshift magnitude diagram, and we found it was a scatter diagram. So I looked at this and thought, well, this is amazing. We published it in Nature. This is amazing. Here I'm on the point of saying that's the end of the theory, and I'm looking for this as the final chopper, as it were.
Yeah.
And what I get is something that's completely in depth. So Burbage and I have kept a watch on this as the number of redshifts of quasars has gone from that original 50 to 3,000 odd, and it's remained exactly the same. There was a new survey that Cron talked about on Friday.
Yes.
Just the same as a scatter diagram.
Yeah.
So
in some sense, that was sort of the low point in your confidence in steady state, a minimum.
But I still didn't have any great confidence in it, as it is shown by the fact that following it in 66, together with Fowler and Wagner, we did the helium lithium.
That's right. That's right.
Thing.
You spent the time on that.
So that's right. So I was beginning to to think in terms of the Big Bang cosmology. That favoured it. And
I'd be interested in your views on...
So I have no difficulty in keeping an open mind. So I just kept my mind open. And my mind has been open sort of all through the past 20 years. I haven't known which way to go.
But you like playing the role of provocateur also. I mean, obviously, contrarian philosophy.
It's just that I had to slave so much when I was a student. Although my instincts were towards physics, the subject I read at the university was mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to slave so much over accurate proofs that I really don't finally believe anything till I've got an accurate proof. And so, you know, a mathematician, if some other fellow comes along and says, I proved it, and you can see he hasn't, you pointed out, there are all sorts of people proving Fermat's last theorem, but
right.
You're not an agent provocateur because you're showing where his mistake is.
Yes.
So I feel that the logic is slack in physics, in particularly in astronomy, and so I've always acted that way.
That's interesting,
that way,
they're
not properly trained, sort of, logically.
Mm-hmm. Interesting comment. I'd be interested in your opinion about why the astronomical and physical community as a whole, after all this wrangling over steady state versus evolving cosmology, pretty much within a year reached a consensus. The microwave background, was it that they were tired of the wrangling, they wanted to grab on something, or was it that it really was such a beautiful prediction that it was textbook science in the sense that or was it that people feel uncomfortable, as you were saying earlier, unless they're all agreeing on something?
It had all the advantages. It satisfied the facts, which were in a certain sense predictive. It was culturally acceptable. And there is a natural tendency in a subject that's as difficult as astronomy for people to tend to herd together in their beliefs, just as fish do in the sea when there are predators around. In a difficult situation, there's no people who are more like to be conformist more than people that are in difficult subjects. Subjects where you have more control, you get wider ranges of opinion, but in biology and astronomy, where the subject is so far ranging, you'll find people converge all on the same beliefs, more or less as a protective phenomenon.
It's almost opposite to what it should be.
It's opposite to what it should be.
That's
to
right.
Protect their sanity. So this seemed to be the way it went. And so I, as I say, kept an open mind over the past 20 years. I've just stood back and watched, and I know perfectly well throughout the history of science that when you get a right theory, correct theory, the progress is very rapid, always, but it hasn't been. I watched the redshift magnitude diagram for the quasars and seen that there's something funny about it, which isn't very well understood. I mean, there's no distance indicator in there at all, so if you say there's evolution, the evolution that there's been is precisely that which is required to conceal the distance. So I regard that as funny. I also noticed that if you talk to a young person today and say, what is the best evidence for your beliefs, the best evidence they would quote is that evidence that we had in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't have anything later to offer.
Yes.
And I regard that as suspicious too.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah,
that's my position now. But I have never been willing to become active again in cosmology until I could see how to deal with the microwave background. And where I'm quite pleased now is I see, having reviewed all the possibilities, that there is one that will do it, and that it is quite testable. We can get at it astrophysically. I don't believe that within a year there can be really very much doubt about this, because we have the far infrared observations that we didn't have. Basically, when Frank Lowe discovered sources in the far infrared, he opened out a new field, and he knew that. And when he did it, and people wouldn't believe him because we couldn't believe there could be particles
so large to radiate efficiently.
To have such a large radiating efficiency in the far infrared.
Yeah.
So this really told us that there was a particle there. And so now we're faced with a situation that we can go to 200 microns, 300 microns, and if you believe these people who've worked in the Antarctic, you can go to 2 millimeters. That's through the maximum of the microwave background. It's a question now, if you believe the Crab Nebula, you can go to 10 centimeters with the particles. It's the kind of situation I like, that we can do something about it.
Right.
You know, I'm not involved in speculation anymore.
Right.
I've been calculating the infrared sources. I can now, using these kind of particles, I can calculate their structures and do a lot of mathematics on it, and that's the sort of position I like to be in.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I take you back to the 50s again for a topic that we've only briefly mentioned, but you wrote several papers on it, and that was the radio source mechanisms. What was the physics that was producing it? Of course, this was a puzzle, and to me, the central question
far more than these questions you've been raising, the nature of the sources.
In the history, is why did it take so long for the ideas of synchrotron radiation that Ginsberg and his students, and then a couple of years later, Shklovsky, were so strongly putting forth in the Soviet Union from 1951 onwards, to become accepted in the West, especially considering that the original suggestion of synchrotron in an astronomical context, as you know, were two papers in Phys Rev.
By Schwinger.
Not in the astronomical context. Schwinger worked out...
There was a paper, was it in Phys Rev by Alfvén and Herlovsen?
Alfvén and Herlovsen.
That was just done for stars, wasn't it?
Alfvén and Herlovsen were interested in for radio stars. And of course, it fit in with Alfvén's ideas of a magnetic field being important in a solar system sized body.
Well, Ginsberg.
A couple months later, Kiepenhauer suggested the synchrotron to explain the galactic background and worked it out in a brief paper in Phys Rev letters. Same year, 1950. And then this just died there, except that Hutchinson in the Cavendish did a paper, and there was one or two other things, but no one picked this up.
It was such that I turned to this in 53 in total ignorance of all the other thing. And there was a conference in Washington in early, January 54.
That's right, the Radio Astronomy Conference,
yeah.
Right.
And if you read that, I gave a paper on doing the thing by synchrotron. It was all plasma.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that paper. They attacked
me furiously. Alfvén was there, and he stood up and said, but I wrote a paper with... he kind of defended his priority from 1950. And I looked it up, and sure enough, it was there. I got the same formula as I had. But it was for stars. It wasn't for distributed thing. And when I printed this as a note in Nature in January 54... And because Alfvén appointed this, I referenced it.
Well, that paper I'll have to check.
Was
this in JGR? It was in JGR, the proceedings of this meeting, so I suspect it was.
Yeah, but it's also in Nature.
It's also in Nature,
yeah.
Okay.
Now, Ginsberg, in his book on cosmic rays, he references 53 for the first Russian publication.
Well, no, it's 51. It really is.
Well, I don't know whether you've got it, but Ginsberg's reference in his book is 53.
Well, I'll check that.
So that, if that's the right reference, because he says basically that the priority was the claims that it was before that were wrong, and his paper was the first in 53, I don't know whether that's true, but the real reason is that Russian papers weren't translated. I knew nothing about them whatsoever. That we had no translation of them whatsoever. And it was the plasma physics lobby that overwhelmed everything.
And the Russians weren't coming to the meetings stage.
So that's the reason. We didn't know what they'd done.
But apparently, and these two Phys Rev letters in 1950 just fell on stone.
That's right, because of the plasma. And if you read that Washington conference, I was practically plowed under.
Because I was
a lone voice.
That's right.
I was quite annoyed about this because it was right, and I had to face the static at that. And I lost, as soon as I realized the Russians had done it, I had no priority, so I never. But I spent 2 or 3 years of really hard work to get to that position myself, sort of investigating conductivity properties and so forth. So,
and your main motivation to be looking at that was the radio astronomy problem?
Yes.
I see. Could you just sort of outline what you did during those 2 or 3 years?
Well, it was really the technical question of what currents could flow in magnetic fields and understanding the conductivity problems. I spoke about at some length
at that 51 meeting,
conference.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that was in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And just to some extent, this obscured the synchrotron business. It was the technical problem of how the currents flow. Because the problem really is that you have a magnetic field and that inhibits currents from flowing across it.
Right.
You can flow along the magnetic field without any problem. So there are all sorts of things as to whether you could have cosmic systems where the currents were always along the direction of the magnetic fields. And so one got snarled up in that kind of problem.
So the standard assumption today of a virtually infinite conductivity was not...
Well, nowadays nobody bothers about the conductivity
right,
problem,
but
we did, and
right.
So it was trying to understand this whole matter that occupied us at the time of the Massey conference, the Boyd conference in London. That seemed to be the big problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's just possible that if you look in some of the remarks. That Ryle did say something about synchrotron radiation.
It
sticks in my memory that he did.
He did. He called it the Schwinger mechanism.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So you could say that he had the concept.
Well,
earlier.
But he didn't follow up on it, though.
He didn't follow up on it.
He didn't put a student on it or
that's
something.
That's right. You know? I followed up on it. And I went to Caltech. I think it was at the end of the Michaelmas term, 53. In Cambridge, because you have to remember we had very heavy teaching loads in those days, and I got away and I got into the library at Robinson and
at Caltech.
Over Christmas I got the theory, and that's why I talked about it in Washington. It was very hot in my mind at that time. I got it all then,
mm-hmm.
And I was high on it, and especially as everybody was disagreeing with me, it never occurred to me that I wasn't the first.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when Alfheim stood up and said, "But I did this with Herlovsen in his complaining voice," I was shocked. You know,
yeah, right.
And of course, I rushed to the literature and I found that he was right, that he'd done it. So I referenced
but now
him.
Properly. When you were working on all these problems of the physics, were you concerned with all of the venues, as it were, of the radio, namely solar bursts, radio sources, the galactic background?
I'm concerned with the whole lot,
yeah,
yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So I was intrigued that it might do the whole lot. But there are obvious questions that you need very high electron energy and so forth, but I felt very excited when I went to Washington for this. And as I say, I remember having a long talk with Charlie Towns about it. And he was intrigued, but he still preferred the plasma oscillation.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't persuade Charles that it was synchrotron radiation.
And so, by the time that your talk, you were quite convinced.
I was convinced,
but the community as a whole wasn't. It's
interesting that the whole astronomical community, it's just the herd instinct. The buzzword was plasma oscillations
right.
at that time.
And would you agree that the thing that once again made the herd switch was largely the work that Oort did with Walt, with Vulture.
It was Dombrowski's discovery of the polarization
right.
of the crab, and then he followed it up.
Right. That didn't make much impression.
It wasn't with Vulture, no. Oort did it alone first. If you look, I think, in the literature, it's a big paper by Oort, and then he put Vulture on to follow it up.
Right.
And then
they were following up the Russian discovery, but once again, I don't think that Russian discovery made any impression in the West.
No, but the Dutch verified. Of course, there's always been some doubt as to whether Dombrowski really did it. But the Dutch verified it.
Yeah.
And it was that, and this happened very quickly. So it was a bad...
That came within a year.
Like my experience with Dickie, we were on the verge of it. I felt I got it, and I had, but it was too late. And then the polarization came along and the thing.
And then the problem became, now where do these high-energy electrons come from? Or let me ask another question before we get to that. Do you think that one inhibiting force might have been the fact that you had not actually detected electrons in the cosmic rays? Or was it really no problem? There were bound to be at least a few percent electrons in the early 50s now.
Well, I think the circumstance, that point undoubtedly weakened people's resolve to sort of investigate this, and I don't believe it was seen as I don't recall ever being criticized by people who said there couldn't be electrons, but had there been electrons, had it been known, then it would have driven people much more strongly. Right.
Because of course you had to assume some number for them, and that's certainly a weakness.
That's right.
Yeah. But now you had to go to the question of the source of electrons, and you had several papers where you talk about things like matter and antimatter. You had a couple papers with Jeff Burbidge on that. Another thing with...
But didn't we decide finally it wouldn't work or something?
To be frank, I haven't looked at that paper. I've just seen an abstract.
I seem to remember publishing an article with Jeff in the Scientific American, and the conclusion was that it was going to be difficult to make it work.
And then, of course, like you said, you had the Cygnus double, which wasn't saying that radiation was nowhere near the optical emission. And so, what were you making of it? I mean, you mentioned the name of Ambart Soumian in a different concept. Was that at all attractive in the late 50s? I know you went to that Solvay conference in 58, where Ambart Soumian was.
It wasn't too bad, you see, because. We'd had Fermi's theory of cosmic rays.
Yes.
And we also had the people who believed in collisions of galaxies.
Right.
And so there were going to be a lot of... I think one of the arguments I used, for instance, about the Cassiopeia source, I may have mentioned that in my note in Nature, that there are high velocities there. So the possibility for working a Fermi mechanism on the electrons was there. So I don't think we were very worried about this. I'm pretty sure in that thing written in 54, I used the very high speeds of the Cassiopeia filaments in relation to Fermi's theory.
Right, and that was often talked about as a common property of the identified sources.
There were always the
high dispersions.
Yeah, so we weren't. Cass
and
you weren't too much
worried.
Perseus A. That's right. So it all seemed to fit rather nicely to the idea of a pumping mechanism.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the colliding galaxies idea. That was another thing that was largely accepted, and the only thing that I can see why it should have gone on so long with really not that much evidence in his favor was the authority of Botta and Minkowski.
And Spitzer, yes.
And would you agree with that?
Yes, I would.
And of course, Botta was very taken that they had worked on this theory of how you produce S-zeros, and then a year later, there it is on the plate.
That's right, yes. Botta was very excited, and of course Botta was a very convincing chap. But Botta was the best convincing person I've ever come across, because he didn't do it by authority. He did it by his ebullient personality, his friendly personality. And he was so bubbling in every direction that you felt impelled to believe him. There was no heavy Dutch father about Walter at all. It was all done in the most friendly...
Was it maybe like Bart Bach personality?
The same kind of personality, but backed up by an immense knowledge of observational astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
So he was full of arguments and so on.
Let me ask about Botta Minkowski. It's amazing to me that these two men, in the later stages of their career, age 50, 55 or so, embraced this radio astronomy and spent so much of their last parts of their career on this, what largely turned out to be fruitless. I mean, an awful lot of wasted time. Of course, some of it was very good. You have any insight into why they would have done that rather than sort of continue on with much more traditional astronomical studies?
Yes. They were just before the big advance in photoelectric methods.
That's right.
And the thing which depressed Walter totally was the inability to calibrate accurately their photographic plates at low flux values.
Right.
He said that the big problem, if only they could calibrate their plates, he would have a tremendous slew of discoveries, but he would not try to speculate. I told you before, it was from Walter I did. Yes. Got this feeling that the data had to be good,
right.
And he would never fudge his magnitude scale, mm-hmm. as we used to call it. Mm-hmm. He was looking for, desperately looking for accurate calibration of his plates, accurate photoelectric calibration. And so he felt that he had all sorts of things there, but it was unsound.
Yes.
And so in that sort of position, he was waiting for the photoelectric parts. So anything he could do that was interesting in the meantime, he was going to do.
So this qualitative science fit in very nicely. Give me an accurate position, and I can take some really good spectra and some really good photographs.
That's right. It fitted what he.
Yes.
And he sort of felt that this was an interim period. He could see that the photoelectric methods were coming that would open out the field he really hoped to mm-hmm. get into.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed all. Natural to him to go that way. I think
that's an interesting.
I think that's
point of view. Yeah, because it seems to me that they were both conservative people, primarily. I mean,
they were.
And yet they're embracing this very speculative field.
But it was their very conservatism that they wouldn't shout aloud with inaccurately calibrated results that led them into it.
Yeah, sort of ironically though, because the radio thing was not a conservative field at all.
That's right. And of course, Walter hit the Cygnus A due to the fact that Graham Smith sent him the position.
Yes, right.
So that got him into it.
But what about the fact that, of course, virtually none of the radio astronomers had any astronomy background at that time? But both of them had been trained as physicists also. Do you think there was any kinship there that they could? You know, many astronomers just wouldn't give the time of day to these people because they just weren't trained right. They didn't know what precession was, and therefore they couldn't be producing anything worthwhile. Do you think there was anything there? Whereas they took them into the fraternity. I mean, you know, there's endless correspondence between Botta, Minkowski, and all of the major groups.
They
treated them as equals right from the start.
That could be due to a difference of training. Walter started as a mathematician, and I think Minkowski is a physicist. So they had come, as it were, mm-hmm. astronomy wasn't
right.
their first
right.
discipline, so that that could have been the reason.
Yeah, I was just wondering. Well, let me just conclude with a overall kind of question. Looking at the era we've been talking about, the 20 years after World War II, what would you see as the way that radio astronomy influenced astronomy and astrophysics in two different fronts? The first, in the way it was done, the style, as it were, and the second thing, the intellectual side, the what we know about the universe. What are its real contributions?
Well, I think it's very difficult at this distance removed to realize how shut in the astronomical world was, say, in 1945 when the Second World War ended. And that was particularly so in the UK. This was, as it were, the first opening of horizons, which has continued, of course, with the other wave bands, say, running from the far infrared now to the X-ray region.
Can you expand on what you mean by shut in? Do you simply mean confined to the visual, or do you mean confined mentally also?
We were confined. What I mean is that we were shut in observationally, and that led to a shutting in of the mind. Did you hear Don Osterbrock's talk?
Yes.
But what was remarkable about that is that how much those early pioneers on the West Coast managed to do with what we could see nowadays as hopelessly, almost hopelessly crude instruments, because they had an access to the world, they were able to look. And that attitude that you have to look at the world was absent in the astronomy of 1945, particularly in the UK. It was absent also on the East Coast in the States. It was only on the West Coast.
You mean it was sort of an exploratory view rather than setting up long projects on stellar statistics or on...
Well, it's a question of which way around you write the logic. Eddington was a great believer that you really didn't need to observe the world, because if your logic was good, you could deduce it. And Eddington was so good that he managed to do fine things with that attitude. But if the world is shut to you, that is the attitude you develop. In its most extreme form, it showed in the 15th and 16th century, where they got into this tremendous religious syndrome when they couldn't get out of it because they had no input from the real world. I mean, Galileo, his crime to that society wasn't so much that he wanted the sun to be the center or the all bodies fall at equal speed. It was the fact that he said, no, your way of life is wrong. You've got to look at the world and allow the world to control you, not you controlling the world. That's the issue. Mm-hmm. And we were getting back into the the syndrome of trying to control the world.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, radio astronomy in Britain was an escape from that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say the attitude of the older generation in resenting it was the same as the church resenting Galileo. It was a reflection of the same sort of syndromes on the two sides. And of course the radio astronomers believed that they didn't realize that what they had was a gift of the world. They believed it was their own merit. And in that sense, to me, they were objectionable personalities, a lot of them.
This is harking back to your previous comment about the universe is there.
That's right. It doesn't exist for us. Yeah. I mean, we simply allow ourselves to be programmed by the universe.
Yeah.
And in other words, they didn't have the necessary humility, so that might have added to it.
You think that's true for them as a group? I mean, obviously you feel that about Martin Ryle.
Well, people like Bolton
also
were okay. Yeah. I mean, John...
Oh, were okay.
But I think the whole group, to some extent, had its ego inflated by the circumstance. And
well, so many fantastic discoveries following...
I think you have to take a person like Jansky and say, well, he, as it were, deserved his success because he worked for it. But in another sense, with the radio astronomers after the war, they didn't work. It wasn't their merit, as it were, that provided them with the techniques. It was the fact that we all worked during the war for these techniques.
Right.
And it was those techniques that provided radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And as it were, the people who came in on it were like those people who win a horse race.
Yes,
a certain sense.
They had the tools, they had the backing.
They had the tools, and the universe was there. And between these two, they couldn't fail. That's the situation. But I think it might have been Walter Bard who said to me, well, these people are... he said, I think it was Walter, he said, I've seen it with the photoelectric people. Sort of feel that they are everything when the technique first come in, but they eventually settle down and become a sort of part of astronomy generally. He says you'll see that will happen to radio astronomy, and that's exactly what's happened. I mean,
mm-hmm.
To be a radio astronomer today is to be quite ordinary.
Yes,
you have
right.
to be an X-ray astronomy or something like that to be the
gravitational wave.
The current
wave
white
or something,
yeah. Right. Whitehead boy.
But now, do you think that attitude in radio astronomy stayed on even beyond 1955, say?
Oh, yes. It stayed right on through the 60s. And it, in a sense, it, you can say it, in Bernard Lovell, he was in 1970. I was in a position where I could have handed Bernard a check for £4.5 million across the table to build a copy of the Bond dish.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to build his own.
Right.
And he wouldn't have cared if it was only 1 meter larger than the Bond dish, as long as it was the largest largest thing in the world. And actually, that project escalated, and I'm not sure just when the Research Council cut it off, but it was over 10 million when they cut it off and said, we're not going to do it. And he still feels he was badly done by. Well, I sort of feel that, that no man should feel that he's badly done by if a country is willing to spend 10 million quid on his what he wants to do. So, undoubtedly, due to the fact that they had the technique due to radar and that the universe was ripe, as it were, for revealing itself, they took on the laurel wreaths sort of to themselves.
Yes, yes.
And to some extent that might have accounted for why the older generation reacted as they did.
Mm-hmm. And so there were two aspects, you're saying. There was the opening of the spectrum, obviously, but there was also the fact that their attitudes were different, and this led to conflicts with the older. Do you think there were any positive contributions of their attitudes to the?
Well, the positive contributions was to explode this business of being shut in. You see, they really ruled the roost in England, because we have been shut in on the optical skies. But basically, what they said was optical astronomy is unimportant. I've sat on committees where I've said it's not unimportant, it's a bigger subject than radio astronomy, except we can't do it. But now, I've spoken against Lovell, but let me tell you the other side of the coin. Where a series of projects were there were projects for big telescopes, and there was the project for the Anglo-Australian telescope, and Lovell stood back to allow that to go forward.
Right.
So,
it's
a very mixed bag. I mean, Lovell had his great points as well as... he was a great entrepreneur,
and
so he had to go for what he wanted. But he should have gone for the Bond dish, he should have gone for the copy. But he didn't like to feel that he was copying the Germans, and that was a mistake, because that was a good telescope. But I suppose if he hadn't had this kind of character, he wouldn't have built the 250-foot.
That's exactly right.
That's how
Nor would Martin Ryle develop aperture synthesis, et cetera,
that's
et cetera,
right.
if you didn't have that.
So you have to take it as it stands.
Well, thank you very much.
That's the end of the interview with Fred Hoyle on 22 May 1981 at a somewhat noisy outdoor cafe in Bologna on a nice sunny Sunday morning and a break day in the meeting for the Modern Cosmology in Retrospect. This is also the end of the tape, the side of the tape.